to our next keynote speaker, and it's probably fair to say it's been a rather difficult few years to be a central banker. Gone, it seems, are the days of record lows and opining on whether or not inflation will be structurally low for the long term. Inflation is back, and inflation is back big, meaning, of course, interest rates have been on the march higher. Here in Australia, of course, the cash rate went from a low of 0.1% in April 22 to, as of yesterday, 3.6%. As was mentioned by Fiona Buffini, that is 10 consecutive months of hikes by the RBA. Interestingly, though, still below the RBNZ, the Fed, and the Bank of England. The sharp increases in the cash rate here in Australia hasn't been particularly popular or particularly endeared our next speaker to parts of the populace. The man himself, however, remains steadfast that while an increase in cash rate does have an impact and does put stress on borrowers and households, it would be a lot worse if we were to do nothing and left inflation to run unchecked. But just how far to go in this tightening cycle? Please welcome to the stage the Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia, Dr. Philip Lowe. He will be doing a Q&A following his address with the Australian Financial Review's economics editor, John Kehoe.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for the introduction. It's a great pleasure for me to be able to join this year's Business Summit from the AFR, and it's great to be back here again, so thank you. The number one economic challenge facing Australia is to make sure that the current period of high inflation is only temporary. High inflation's corrosive. I think we all know it's damaging. And if it were to persist, high inflation would lead to even higher interest rates and higher unemployment to ultimately bring inflation back down. So it'd be dangerous indeed to allow the current period of high inflation to persist. The RBA's job as Australia's central bank is to deliver low and stable inflation for all Australians. And the board is resolute in its determination to do this by making sure that inflation does return to the 2-3% target range in reasonable time. The high inflation that we're currently experiencing is one of the legacies of the pandemic and of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The pandemic interrupted the supply side of the global economy, and this pushed up costs and prices. And on top of this, the monetary and fiscal policy response to the pandemic underpinned a strong recovery in aggregate demand, and this too has pushed up costs and prices. Before I discuss inflation and the monetary policy response in more detail, I want to highlight another remarkable, but less remarked upon, legacy of the pandemic, and that's the significant improvement in Australia's labour market. This is a very positive legacy, and it's in the national interest to preserve as much of this as we possibly can. Over recent months, the unemployment rate in Australia has been around 3.5%. I hope you can see here in my first chart, the last time that the unemployment rate was this low was back in 1974. That's nearly 50 years ago. Over recent times, Australians have not only found it easy to get a job, but they've also found it easy to get the hours of work they want. And as a result, measures of underemployment, which you can see here, are also around multi-decade lows. These outcomes have coincided with a record number of Australians joining the labour force. The participation has increased, and the share of working age Australians with a job has never been higher than has been just recently. And as is evident in this next chart, the youth labour force participation rates, the highest that it's been in a long time, and the youth unemployment rate is the lowest it's been in many decades. And female labour force participation has also recently been at a record high. These are really positive outcomes for the country and the society in which we all live. For decades, Australia struggled to achieve what was considered to be full employment. Too many people couldn't find a job, or they couldn't find the working hours they wanted. And this was one dark spot on what has otherwise been a very successful economy over the past three decades. Of course, there are still significant issues in our labour market. But these outcomes that I've just talked about are better than most people thought likely, or perhaps even possible. And there are positive social and economic dividends to this. Our communities are stronger when people who want to work can find a job and get the hours they want to work. Paid work not only generates income, but it helps people develop skills and helps people to progress up the ladder of opportunity. The positive labour market outcomes largely reflect the policy to stimulus that was delivered during the pandemic, the same factor that lies behind some of the current inflation. For a while, disruptions caused by the pandemic made it more difficult for firms to operate, and they had to hire some extra workers to deal with this. But the more important factor has been the support to aggregate demand provided by both the fiscal and monetary policy response during the pandemic. This support was primarily designed to protect against catastrophic economic outcomes, which it successfully did. But it also had the effect of underpinning a strong recovery in aggregate demand that has created jobs and that's delivered a sustainable reduction in unemployment. People have got jobs, kids can get jobs, they can progress up the ladder of opportunity. So it's a positive legacy of the pandemic. I think as we battle with inflation, it's worth remembering there is a more positive side to what's happened as well. And it's in our collective interest to preserve that positive side if we can. But I now want to return to the battle against inflation. In the December quarter, the headline inflation rate reached 7.8%. As you can see here, that's the highest rate in more than three decades. And as we know from the 1970s and the 1980s, high inflation is damaging and it undermines people's living standards. While the circumstances that gave rise to the current high inflation are different to those that occurred in the 70s and 80s, the effect of inflation is exactly the same. It erodes the value of people's savings, puts pressure on household budgets, and it hurts people on low incomes the most. And the economy simply doesn't work well if we've got high inflation. It's harder for businesses to plan, and people have to spend time protecting themselves against inflation rather than on more productive activities. And if inflation does become ingrained in expectations, it requires higher interest rates and a large increase in unemployment to get it back down again. To illustrate this point, as you can see in this graph, in both the United States and Australia, when high inflation became entrenched in the 70s and the 80s, the unemployment rate ultimately had to rise by 5 percentage points to get inflation back down. So if inflation does become ingrained, there is a very large cost to pay. And this is one reason why the Reserve Bank is determined to do what is necessary to make sure that the current period of high inflation is only temporary. We do not want inflation to become ingrained, and we'll do what's necessary to make sure that's the case. The tool that we have to do this is interest rates. I acknowledge that the effect of higher interest rates fall quite unevenly across the community. The most direct effect for households is on the cash flows of people with variable rate mortgages. But this is only one of the many channels through which monetary policy works. Higher interest rates also affect the price of all assets, including the exchange rate and the price of housing. They affect the cost of new finance for all borrowers, and they affect everybody's incentive to save and to spend. Higher interest rates also affect the residential construction cycle and the investment environment facing all firms. They also affect people's expectations of the future, and thus the pricing decisions of firms and wage outcomes in the economy. So there are many channels through which monetary policy works other than the impact on mortgage rates. These various channels take time to work, but they do work, and they are working to establish a better balance of supply and demand in the Australian economy. As I've discussed on previous occasions, the Reserve Bank Board is attempting to navigate a narrow path here. We are seeking to bring inflation down in a timely way while keeping the economy on an even keel. If we can successfully navigate that narrow path, inflation will return to target in reasonable time, and we will be able to preserve some of the gains in the labour market that I spoke about a few minutes ago, and that's certainly our ambition. It's still possible to achieve this, but we do need to be prepared for other outcomes as well, including a sharper rise in unemployment. Given the uncertain world we're living in, there are many sources of uncertainty at the moment, and we could be knocked off that narrow path, but our ambition is to bring inflation down within a reasonable time and to preserve many of the gains in the labour market. As the board navigates this narrow path, it's paying very close attention to developments in the global economy, in household spending, and the outlook for inflation in the labour market. So I'd like to say a few words about each of those variables in light of the recent data. First, the global economy, which is in a challenging position. The IMF is predicting a period of weak growth, especially in advanced economies, and you can see that in this chart. Even so, recent forecast revisions have tended to be the upside, following stronger data in the labour markets in a number of countries and stronger data on household spending and business surveys. And a change in China's COVID policy has also improved the outlook there. The main issue, though, is still inflation. As you can see in this next chart, headline inflation has peaked in most economies, and it's now coming down due to the resolution of supply-side problems, softer growth in demand, and a decline in some commodity prices. So headline inflation has peaked, and it's coming down. Even so, there is still uncertainty about how fast inflation will come back down. In many countries, the prices of services are increasing quickly, and wage growth is above the rate that's consistent with sustainable achievement of the inflation target. Reflecting this in underlying terms, inflation in many countries is proving to be uncomfortably persistent. While most central banks are forecasting that inflation will return to target within the next 2 to 3 years, there are a range of other plausible scenarios where it occurs both quicker and more slowly. In Australia, the monthly CPI indicator for January published last week provided support to the idea that headline inflation has also peaked here in Australia. The monthly indicator is still experimental and can be volatile from month to month, so we've got to exercise some caution. But the year-ended rate did fall from 8.4% in December to 7.4% in January. So it came down a percentage point, and that's a very welcome decline. Within the aggregate result, we now see the first sign that the slower rate of goods price inflation in global markets is being transmitted to Australia. So you can see here in January, clothing prices declined and the prices of household furnishings fell for the first time in quite a while. So there's less inflation pressures in global market, and we've been wanting to see that in Australia, and we're finally starting to see the first evidence that it's being transmitted here. But it's just one monthly figure, and we'll be looking for further evidence in the months ahead that slower inflation in goods pricing global markets is being transmitted to Australia. In contrast, though, the prices of many services in Australia are continuing to rise quickly. Over the summer, there was strong demand for travel, for accommodation and entertainment, and that strong demand resulted in large price increases in those sectors. Rents are also rising rapidly, with rental vacancy rates at very low levels in many parts of the country. Overall, we expect that inflation will trend lower this year and next, but there's still uncertainty about the exact path of the decline. Inflation's still too high, and it will be some time yet before we're back within the 2-3% target range. As part of the board's assessment of the future path of inflation, we are paying close attention to trends in household spending, with the recent data showing a clear moderation. In the December quarter, household consumption increased by just 0.3%, which in per capita terms represents a small decline. As is evident in the graph here, the bounce back in spending following the pandemic has now largely run its course. More fundamentally, the combination of rising cost of living pressures, higher interest rates, and a decline in housing prices is weighing on household consumption. The household saving rate has declined from the very high rates of recent years, as you can see, and it's now slightly below the pre-pandemic average. We're expecting a further decline in the household saving rate due to the ongoing pressures on household finances. But within the overall consumption figures, there are divergent patterns, which you can see here. Per capita spending on goods has softened recently after surging during the pandemic. In contrast, per capita spending on services has been strong recently following the slump during the pandemic. Spending on many services is now back in line with the pre-pandemic trend, with international travel being one exception to this. These divergent patterns are also evident in the bank's liaison, with some firms reporting that demand is still very strong, while others are reporting a noticeable slowing. I think it's also worth noting that business surveys continue to report that trading conditions are above average and capacity utilisation is high, firms are planning to invest and to hire people. Looking forward, we expect a period of subdued consumption growth, especially in per capita terms. This slower growth in consumption will help establish a better balance between supply and demand in the economy and support the return of inflation to target. There are a range of offsetting factors bearing on this outlook. On the positive side, households' wage and salary income increased by more than 10% last year. People have been finding jobs and they've been finding the hours they want to work. And there's a large stock of additional savings that were accumulated over the pandemic period. So they're positives. On the other side, though, interest payments are increasing quickly at a time when inflation is high. This increase in mortgage payments is evident in this next graph. Based on the interest rate increases that have already occurred, including yesterday's, total required mortgage payments are expected to reach 9.5% of household disposable income later this year. As you can see, that will be a record high. Housing prices have also been declining, although it's difficult to determine the effect of this on consumption, given we'd earlier had a big run-up in prices. And the pool of additional savings that I spoke about a minute ago is spread quite unevenly across the community. We're unsure about how those additional savings will be run down. Given this wide range of factors influencing consumption, the board is closely monitoring the spending data at each of its monthly meetings. Turning now to the labour market, the recent data suggests that conditions remain tight in the Australian labour market, although the rapid pace of hiring we saw last year seems to have slowed. As you can see here, the number of job vacancies is still very high, and many firms in the bank's liaison program are reporting they're planning to increase headcount further. They're planning to hire and invest. Notwithstanding this, in January, employment declined by 11,500 and the unemployment rate ticked up to 3.7%. Our interpretation of this decline in employment is that it largely reflects changing seasonal patterns in hiring. It's notable that in early January there were around 100,000 people more than normal, indicating that they had a firm offer to start a job within the next 4 weeks. We expect that many of these people will have commenced work by February, and we'll be looking to see evidence of this in the February employment data. In terms of wages, we recently received new readings on the wage price index and the average earnings from the National. Both indicate that wages growth is stronger than it was a few years ago, and that's a welcome development. It's also positive that the rate of wages growth remains consistent with the inflation target, provided that productivity growth does return to something like its pre-pandemic pace, and that's an important proviso. In the December quarter, the wage price index increased by 0.8%, bringing the year-ended increase to 3.3%. As you can see, that's the strongest outcome in more than a decade. It reflects the tight labour market and the pickup in inflation. The national accounts measure of average earnings per head increased by 0.9% in the quarter and 4.2% over the year. And the per hour measure increased by just 2.5% over the year. These measures have been volatile over recent times due to large compositional shifts in employment and to changes in hours work. And these compositional shifts have made interpretation difficult. But the general message from these data is similar to that provided by the wage price index. Together, these data suggest that the risk of a prices wages spiral remains low. This is helpful as we navigate that narrow path, and it means Australia is in a better position than many other comparable countries. Notwithstanding this, we remain alert to the risks here, given the combination of a tight labour market, a high level of capacity utilisation, and the run of recent higher inflation numbers. While the risk is low, if it did materialise, the costs would be very high. In particular, if prices and wages were to chase one another, the end result would be persistently higher inflation, even higher interest rates, and higher unemployment. I hope you agree it's in our collective interest to avoid that. I'll conclude with yesterday's decision by the board to increase the cash rate by a further 25 basis points to 3.6%. This brings the cumulative increase in interest rates since May last year to 3.5 percentage points. The initial increases were required to remove the extraordinary policy support that was put in place during the pandemic. Our assessment is that the more recent interest rate increases have moved monetary policy into restrictive territory, and that's been necessary to ensure that this current period of high inflation is only temporary. When the board makes its decisions each month, it's managing two risks. One is the risk of not doing enough, which would result in high inflation persisting and then later proving very costly to get down. If inflation persists, we're going to have even higher interest rates and more unemployment. So that's one risk. The other risk is that we move too fast or too far, and the economy slows by more than is necessary to bring inflation back down in a timely way. I'd have to say it's a complex environment in which to be making policy decisions, with many of the variables that we monitor at near record highs or lows. As I said, the inflation rate is at a three-decade high. The unemployment rate is around a five-decade low. Australia's terms of trade are near their highest level ever, near a 150-year high. There's been a record boost to savings over the last couple of years, and interest payments as a share of household income will soon be at a record high. At the same time, measures of consumer confidence are near record lows. So a lot of record highs and a lot of record lows. This all makes making policy challenging at the moment, and there are a range of scenarios for the economy, and there are uncertainties in both directions. Given these uncertainties, the board is monitoring the data very carefully from month to month, and we have the flexibility to respond as needed. Our judgment, though, remains that further tightening of monetary policy is likely to be required to bring inflation back to target within a reasonable time. Inflation is still too high, and while it looks to be on a declining path, it's likely to remain higher than target for a few years. If we don't get inflation down fairly soon, the end result will be even higher interest rates and more unemployment. We best avoid that. At our board meeting yesterday, we discussed the lags in monetary policy, the effects of the large cumulative increase in interest rates to date, and the difficulties that higher interest rates are causing for many households. We also discussed that with monetary policy now in restrictive territory, we are closer to the point where it will be appropriate to pause interest rate increases to allow more time to assess the state of the economy. At what point it will be appropriate to pause will be determined by the data and by our assessment of the outlook. Thank you very much for listening, and I look forward to answering your questions. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Dr. Lowe. We're going to take a seat here on stage, and Phil, I know he doesn't mind me calling that. I think he prefers that rather than being called Governor, so I'll stick with that. Yep. He's agreed to take a few questions initially from me, and then we'll throw to sort of other media and people on the floor as well. Phil, in your speech there, you've hinted that, well, you've suggested that and said that the RBA is close to a pause, and it's going to basically be a month-by-month proposition now for the bank on interest rates. What sort of economic conditions or data would you want to see to be reasonably confident that you could pause the interest rate hikes? And could I just add to that, is the US a cautionary tale? We saw Jay Powell, the US Federal Reserve overnight, chairman, saying we thought we were close, but now actually economic activity is picking up and we're going to have to raise rates higher than what we thought.
Yep. Well, we are closer to a pause, and it's a matter of logic, really. As you increase interest rates higher, you get closer to the point where it is appropriate to stop and for a while and just assess the flow of data. We've done a lot in a short period of time, and at some point it's going to be appropriate to sit still and assess the collective effects of that. Before our next board meeting, we'll have important data on employment. We'll have another monthly inflation indicator. We'll have the more detail on retail spending and the business surveys. So they're four really important pieces of data that we'll look at our next board meeting. If collectively they suggest that the right thing is to pause, then we'll do that. But if they suggest that we need to keep going, then we will do that. So we've got a completely open mind about what happens at the next board meeting. Yesterday we did discuss the lessons from overseas experience, because I remember a few months ago people saying the Western economy or the advanced economies were slowing down, inflation was coming down, the battle was won. Bond yields declined and people were feeling more confident, and then just recently the data, the employment data, particularly in the US and Canada and some other countries, have been stronger, and you saw the response of that to the Fed, by the Fed yesterday. So it is a cautionary lesson. But Australia has some positives that a number of other Western countries don't have. Wages growth here in Australia is still not too high. There's been a very big increase in labour force participation in Australia. We're, as I said, a record high, women, young kids. So right across the distribution, there's been a big increase in labour supply in Australia. That's not the case in the US. And the other consideration that we're giving weight to is the fact that Australians have a lot of variable rate debt. In the US, when the Federal Reserve raises their mortgage rates, if you've got an existing mortgage, you don't pay more. In Australia, you do. So you put those things together, I think we're in a better position than many other countries, but we need to pay attention to what's going on overseas. So if the global economy strengthens again, that'll have implications for us.
You speak about a reasonable time frame to get inflation back into target. At the moment, the forecast is for inflation not to get back to around the upper end of that 2-3% by mid-2025. Is that a reasonable time frame? I would be thinking you wouldn't want to let it slip beyond that. That would be getting into a bit longer territory, I would have thought.
Well, I agree with that. If inflation comes back to 3% by mid-25 and we can keep the unemployment below 5%, that'll be a fantastic outcome, won't it? We've discussed the case for being even more aggressive with interest rates and trying to get inflation back to 3% before the end of 25. It would be possible to do that, but it would come at the cost of foregoing many of those gains in the labour force that I talked about before, and our judgment, at least at the moment, is the benefits we would get from getting inflation back to 3% 6 months earlier at the cost of a lot of job losses isn't worth it. But I agree with you that we want to see inflation back to 3% by 25. Extending it beyond that, I think, is getting too long. But to get it back more quickly, we give up jobs, and I don't think it's worth it.
It's definitely a balancing act. I'm going to throw one more to Phil before I throw to the floor. The RBA review, it's going to be handing its findings to the Treasurer at the end of this month, and he'll release the findings, I think, before the budget. Just going through it yourself, is there any lessons you've learned going through the process or reflections where you think, maybe there's a shortcoming or there's something we could be doing better at the bank? Have you seen through that process something where you've reflected and thought, well, actually, there are things we could be doing better?
Well, we could be doing communication better. I think many people would say that. So I'll be looking forward to their advice on how to do that better. I think the forward guidance we gave during the pandemic has come with costs, hasn't it? So for how we communicate with the market, I think that's the main thing I would be looking for. And there are a range of other issues I know the review committee is looking at, but we'll perhaps at a future event be able to talk about those.
Okay, let's throw it open to the floor. I know there's some other media here pointing at the back. Let's go to Ed Boyd from Sky News. Ed, we'll let you in. You're a former copy kid at the AFR, and your dad is the esteemed Chanticleer columnist, soon to retire, so I think we'll give you one.
Great. Thanks very much, John. Governor Lowe, last month you were described as a hawk this month you're being described as a dove. How can you change from one to the other so quickly?
Well, I can't and I didn't. I mean, the message from the Reserve Bank really since May last year is inflation's too high, we need to keep raising interest rates, and we're on a path to do that. February, we were faced with surprisingly strong underlying inflation, and our forecasts were prepared on the technical assumption that interest rates would get to 3.75%, which required a couple of extra increases from where we were. So the statement last month was drawing people's attention to that. And yesterday was saying interest rates are still likely to go up further, but by when and how much, you've got an open mind. So it's very consistent messaging, although the nuances do change from month to month, as they should, as the data changes. And the media and the financial markets sometimes overinterpret.
But the statement this month was very different to the statement last night. The amount of words were totally changed.
It was, because we had, this month was a kind of a bumper month for data. And for the first time ever, we had the national accounts, inflation, wages, and the labour force all in one month. And those data, on balance, were a bit softer than we had expected. And it's appropriate that we modify our language as the data changes. We're very much in a data-dependent world, and when the data changes, we're going to change the language. But the underlying message has been the same. Inflation's too high, we need to keep raising rates, and we will. When and how much remains to be determined.
Dr. Lowe, if I can jump in next, John, if that's okay. Chris Reason from Seven News. Thanks for taking questions from the media today. I just wanted to ask you, last month you told the Senate Estimates Committee that you listen to Australians. You do receive their letters and you read them and you respond. I'm just wondering if it's got far more serious in tone in the last week now. We're hearing from suicide prevention agencies who have now arranged to meet with you to discuss their concerns. Things out there in Heartland are getting that serious. How much notice, how much recognition, how much... do you listen to those sorts of messages as they come to you? And secondly, given what those messages are, though, given what you've said today, what can you really tell them, what can you really do, given you're saying if you don't keep interest rate rising, the situation will get far worse?
Yeah, I mean, that's a difficult message, isn't it? But it's the truth. If inflation stays high, we know that will lead to higher interest rates, people losing jobs, and more pain. That's the reality we face. It's an uncomfortable reality, but that's the reality, and it's a very difficult message for people to hear. At yesterday's board meeting, I went through with the board the mail that I've been receiving, and we discussed it in quite a lot of detail, the difficulties that many people are obviously facing who've borrowed in recent times and are facing big increases in mortgages. People write to me how it's affecting their families and their mental health. And as you said, in the next month I'm meeting with Suicide Prevention and Lifeline to talk about what they're hearing as well. So we're very alert to that. And it weighs heavily on my heart and the hearts of the board members. But at the same time, we know that if we don't get on top of inflation, higher interest rates, more unemployment, more pain. We think we can navigate this narrow path and bring inflation down and keep many of the gains in the labour market. But if we don't get inflation down, we'll be in all sorts of trouble. So it's a difficult message at an individual level, and it weighs on us a lot. And I read the many letters, and often I respond to them. But it's interesting, we've also been receiving letters recently saying, this is the first time that Ben, I being the governor, thank you for preserving the value of money. Because there are parts of the community who know how damaging inflation is. So it's a difficult time.
G'day, Dr. Lowe. Daniel Sutton from Channel 10. Hello, yes. bright lights, I apologise. You acknowledged in your speech the effects of high interest rates are felt unevenly across the community. Obviously, the whole point's to try and reduce spending, and we can clearly see the impact on low and middle income mortgage holders, indirectly as a result, renters. The question many people are asking, though, is what about the top end of town? You did touch on this in your speech, but how are you encouraging the top end of town to reduce their spending? And to illustrate that point in a cheeky way, I suppose, have you personally felt the need to rein in your spending in recent months?
Well, I'm just one person in 26 million, so my personal circumstances aren't going to affect the aggregate, are they? So, it's difficult because monetary policy is falling unevenly across the community, and the people who are being most affected are people who borrowed in recent times and having to pay higher mortgage payments. So that's where the effect is being most felt. But higher interest rates have diffuse effects elsewhere. Just imagine if we had not raised rates, where do you think the exchange rate would be? Much lower. We'd have more inflation. The higher interest rates do encourage people to save a bit more. You can now, if you shop around, and please shop around for deposits, you can get high fours, and that increases 4% on your savings. So shop around, that increases the incentive to save. And housing prices have fallen, partly because of higher interest rates. And at least for some people, the lower wealth they feel as a result of lower housing prices means they spend less. So there are diffuse transmission channels, but the most direct one, you're right, is on higher mortgage payments. I know it's tough.
I know we do have some audience questions as well. There's a lady in the middle of the room here. If we could get a mic. Oh, okay. Let's go up the back there. Thank you. On the other side of the room.
Thank you, Dr. Law, for such factual information and sharing with us all this data. Matt Comyn yesterday mentioned that it's very difficult to anticipate the future, and if someone can predict what has happened in the last 2 years, probably these people are not sitting in this room anyway. So my question is quite simple. It's out loud and clear that we need to get inflation under control. The question is, do you think we have a strategy? And second part of the question, do you think we have the right people to execute on this strategy?
Sorry, can you repeat the last bit? Because I didn't.
Do you think we have a strategy to recover and get back and attack inflation? And do you think we have the right people in our government, in banking system, to execute on this strategy?
I think the question was, do you have the right strategy to get inflation under control? And second to that, do you have the right people to be able to carry out that strategy?
Do we have the right strategy? We have one tool, the Reserve Bank. We have one tool, and that's interest rates, and we're using it. And I've tried to set out today on other occasions, our strategy is to keep raising interest rates to the point where confident inflation is going to come back down, but we're not trying to get it back down instantaneously. We want to preserve the gains in the labour market as much as we can and allow time for inflation to come down. So that's our underlying strategy. And do we have the right people? We were asking about the question, really about the composition of the board, I guess, and this is going to be discussed as part of the review. But I can tell you, you've got 9 people on the Reserve Bank board who take their job incredibly seriously. We look at all the data, and we're collectively committed to preserving price stability and as many of the gains in the labour market we can achieve. So that's our the way we operate in our strategy, and the Reserve Bank review will presumably opine on the composition of the board.
Another question from the middle of the room here.
Dr. Lowe, good morning. I'm from Pendle Group. A question for you about the reopening of China. How do you expect that to affect both inflation in Australia this year and also the inflation outlook globally?
I don't think it's material for the inflation outlook, but it is a positive for our economy. We've seen the prices of the steel-making commodities pick up a bit as China has opened. Chinese students are starting to come back to Australia, and we're hoping within a short period of time there will be greater air travel between Australia and China, and tourists and business people from China will start visiting Australia as well. So it's a positive for the Australian economy in the short term, and I don't think it has any particular implications for inflation.
We've got another question from Sally Patton up the front here on one of the front tables. A colleague from the Australian Financial Review and in charge of BOSS.
Thank you, Dr. Liu. As interest rates rise, unemployment is presumably going to rise too. I'm just wondering if you can comment on what level of unemployment is acceptable to the Reserve Bank.
I don't want to kind of put a figure on it. Our forecasts that we released a month ago have the unemployment rate rising to 4.5 or maybe a bit above that. So that's a percentage point above where it is now. Remember, before the pandemic, we were above 5, and we wondered whether we could get in a sustainable way below 5. I think it's possible, although there's still a lot of uncertainty around this, I think it's possible we can sustain an unemployment rate below 5% in Australia. I certainly hope so. And if we can travel that narrow path, we'll do that. We want to minimise the rise in unemployment, but we acknowledge that slower growth does mean higher unemployment. But if we can stay on that narrow path, we can keep it below 5.
Michael Stutchbury, the Editor-in-Chief of the Australian Financial Review.
Thanks, John. Thank you, Governor. Overnight, there's been, as mentioned, the statements by the US Federal Reserve Chair has been interpreted as slightly more hawkish comments for the future of US interest rates. Your statement yesterday and today has been interpreted as being slightly more dovish and thinking about a pause of rates. And as you mentioned, maybe the difference between the US and Australia is that Australia has a high use of variable mortgage interest rates, so you have a quicker transmission of the higher interest rates, and there's been no great resignation in Australia, so we've got the labour supply has increased. But notwithstanding that, the Australian dollar's taken a little bit of tumble overnight, and it's down, you know, now with 65 US cents in front of it, which, as you noted as well, could be a little bit inflationary. Do you think it matters if the financial markets don't see the distinction in what you're saying, and is that the Australian cash rate path does not really have to catch up with the US Federal Reserve funds rate, that we can have a lower profile of interest rates possibly than the US during this episode?
Yep. For some months now, the financial markets have priced in quite different profiles for our interest rate than at the Fed. The Fed rate was getting into 5.25. I haven't seen what it is this morning, but it could be a bit higher than that. And our rate has been, at least in financial market pricing, a bit over 4. So financial markets have lived for some time with an expected difference of 1 percentage point between rates here and in the United States. And the exchange rate has been broadly steady in trade-weighted terms for months now. But there are, as I said before, important differences between the US and Australia. Now, the wage outcomes, that's a really, really important difference. I was in India the weekend before last, and talking to Chair Powell and a number of other central bank governors, our labour market outcomes are quite different. Higher participation, more people joining the labour force, immigration starting again here, so labour force is expanding, and wage outcomes okay, and variable rate debt. So they're important differences, and I think if the market doesn't understand that, it would be better if they did, but I don't think it's particularly problematic.
Question up the back here from, I think it's, oh, we'll go to the front and then maybe go to Lynn after that.
Yeah, Graham Cartwright. Just on Nehru, I think last year we had 3.5% unemployment. You put up a whole lot of stats which were saying the economy was growing quite strongly, and without perhaps really worrying about inflation coming through at that stage. We've got 3.5% unemployment roughly now and quite high inflation for a range of factors that you've covered. But how far do you think we need to go to get back to Nauru? Was it closer to 4 or 5, or have you got any sort of real feel on why we didn't see too much inflation as we went down through the 4s on the way down?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, and there's still a lot of uncertainty. As I said before, I think we can sustain an unemployment rate below 5. How far below 5 remains to be determined, I'm not sure. I think for me, the more important issue is productivity growth. Now, over the last 3 years, cumulatively, output per head in Australia hasn't increased. It's been a difficult 3 years with COVID and all the disruptions. We've had really 3 years with very little change in output per hour worked. That's the bigger challenge for us, because if output per hour work isn't rising, then real wages growth is going to be weak, real asset price growth is going to be weak, the fiscal challenges are going to be harder, and the business environment's harder. So that's, for me, that's kind of, I didn't really talk about that today in much detail, but I think that's a really important issue for us collectively to face into. I don't really know what the Naira is, I think it's below 5, but I do know that our lives are going to be much easier if productivity growth can pick up in the last 3 years has not been good.
I know Lynn Cobley had a question on this side of the room.
Thank you very much, Governor, and thank you for all the hard work you've been doing under a lot of pressure over these last few years. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
One of the other parts of the RBA's remit is an efficient payment system. So just to move the conversation somewhere else, you've recently developed a central bank digital currency, and you've got 14 use cases, I understand, that you're going to work on. Just interested in your reflection on where that might go and where what that could mean strategically for the market, depending on the outcomes of those trials.
Well, they're trials, and some will hopefully be successful and others will probably fall by the wayside, as happens here. My own view, at least at the moment, is that there are going to be some important wholesale use cases for a central bank digital currency that kind of really behind the scenes that most people don't actually see, but they will improve the efficiency of the payments and settlement processes. I'm still very sceptical that at least in Australia there will be a central bank digital currency for retail purposes that we all use to make payments. We've got a very efficient payment system in Australia where you can move money between any two bank accounts in the country in 5 seconds just by knowing someone's mobile phone number. And it's free. So we ask ourselves at the Reserve Bank, how could we offer digital tokens which would be better than that? It'd be costly for us to develop, and maybe we could develop them and maybe they would be useful, but at the moment we don't think the public policy case is there. But in the wholesale space, fixing up some of the frictions and inefficiencies in the system, I think a new settlement instrument by us could help. And if we can find a way to help, we will. So these experiments will hopefully give us some good ideas.
Just to follow up there, Phil, and a final question. You sound sceptical. You said you were about the case for retail central bank digital currency in Australia, but it does seem like the rest of the world's moving a lot faster than what we thought only 6 or 12 months ago. Obviously, China, Europe, the UK, Canada, even the US, there's some noise there out of the US Congress about getting on their bike and doing this because they're worried that China might get ahead of them. If they proceed with a retail central bank digital currency, can Australia afford not to, or do we have to get sucked into that as well?
Well, I don't think we'd be sucked into it. If they do this because they think there's a public policy case to do it, then we would look at the arguments and the experience and decide whether those same arguments apply here. And if this is the way the world goes, then we'll be part of it. But at least at the retail level, you shouldn't expect us to be at the right at the front, but we could be a fast follower. Our organisational effort really at the moment is on the frictions in the payments and settlements processes, which are quite costly, and overcoming those, because if you can already move money between any two bank accounts in 5 seconds using a mobile phone number for free. Now, it's a very efficient system, and soon you'll be able to use QR codes to do it as well. So if we're going to introduce a new payment method and all the costs and risks that come with that, I want to be sure that the costs don't exceed the benefits. Mm. We're not there yet. If we are, then we'll do it, but we're not there yet.
We are out of time. Could you please put your hands together for Phil Lowe, the Governor of the Reserve Bank?
Thank you.